Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Caitlin.
Cowabunga.
That's the intro?
Yeah?
Sorry. Cowabunga. Is that... Sorry. Hold on. I'm new here. When someone says cowabunga, is it generally considered polite to return the cowabunga, or do you? Is it just to be received? Is it in a very cowabunga to you?
Well, I think normally it wouldn't be used as a greeting. It's not like a...
It's not aloha. It's
not, right.
Okay. It's more a term of... excitement. It's not an expletive. What's the word?
It's an exclamatory.
Yes.
It's an exclamatory. Okay. I am a linguist, so this is really helpful for me. So cowabunga, it's a way of saying, wow.
Woohoo! We did it.
How exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And a very cowabunga to you, Caitlin.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
We were just joking, since Jamie, you mentioned that you're new here. You're rather new to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles franchise.
Yeah, I'm extremely young, so it's hard for me.
We were just joking off mic with our guest, who we will introduce in a moment, that he has a PhD in Ninja Turtles. I have a master's degree in both Turtles and screenwriting from Boston University, which of course I hate to mention.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And we were joking that you're like a freshman in high school when it comes to Ninja Turtles, Jamie.
Yeah, I'm throwing back to my early days of the podcast where I'm like, I don't know anything. But in this case, it is actually fairly true. TMNT is outside of my purview. I'm the new girl at school and I love homework. So I'm excited to learn in my yellow jacket that appears to be canonical, but I don't think appears in this movie.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. See, I'm learning already. She's got a little Morton Salt Girl jacket.
So this is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Secret of the Ooze episode of the Bechdel cast.
Requested by everyone.
Our most popular request. People have just been clamoring.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Pride and Prejudice, Secret of the Ooze. And we've done all of them pretty recently, so you're welcome.
True. You're welcome. So this is the Bechdel cast, our show in which we examine movies through an intersectional feminist lens. My name is Caitlin Durante.
My name is Jamie Loftus. Cowabunga to you.
Mm-hmm. Cowabunga to us all.
Mm-hmm. Please. Oh, and everyone, if you're sitting next to someone, we can make it like Sunday service. Could you turn to the person to your left and say, very cowabunga to you. And then turn to the person to your right and say a very cowabunga to you. And then let's just sit in our own cowabunga and then say cowabunga to yourself. you know?
Yeah.
I don't think we stop often enough to say cowabunga to ourselves.
I tend to agree.
That's self-care. That's just basic self-care. You sit, you breathe, you say cowabunga, you know?
Yeah.
Really feel each syllable in your mouth. I've been listening to a lot of guided meditations. What's the podcast about?
Well, I already said that, but I didn't say what the Bechdel test is.
Sorry, yes. What is it?
Jamie, maybe you need to take a minute and just like have a cowabunga.
I need to say cow. I'm sorry. Sorry. I'm going to pull back.
Okay. The Bechdel test is a media metric created by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test, which we use as a jumping off point. And it's a media metric where our version is two characters of a marginalized gender have to have names, they have to speak to each other, and their conversation has to be about something other than a man. Mm-hmm. Ideally for a meaningful exchange, something that's kind of, you know, plot relevant.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And this movie, IDK.
IK.
UK?
IK, for sure.
But without much further ado, let us introduce our guest.
Yeah.
He has a recent PhD in sociology and Ninja Turtles. He's a host of Play Hype Dialogue, a media podcast. He's an aspiring screenwriter. It's Carlos Camacho.
Carlos!
Hello. I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you.
Thank you for being here. And to everyone who cannot see our video call, which is all of you, Carlos is wearing a Bechdelcast Queer Icon t-shirt. It's incredible. We love to see it. How are you, Carlos? Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really well in the moment. I'm really excited to be here to talk about the Turtles. I revisited them for the first time in a while, so I'm so excited.
Cowabunga, baby. Let's do this.
Tell us your history, your relationship with this franchise.
So I was born in 1989, so I was like primed for Taylor Turtle Swift. Fandom.
Taylor Swift over here.
So I'm gonna post this to my Instagram, but this is a stuffed Raphael from when I was a literal child. So I've literally been around this property my whole life. My family is always getting me turtle stuff. Like, it is very much something I've watched, read, played video games of, stuffed animals, played turtles. I've done all of it. It's been there from pretty much my inception into this world.
Nice. Music.
That's so cool.
Jamie, what about you?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I think I briefly pretended in high school to know what it was and what it was about, but I don't know. I think that TMNT, as I know they're called, it's like almost like a micro generational thing where it's like if you're born 1 or 2 years outside of the target audience, you just missed it, because they kind of I know that they like they still very much exist. It feels like as like everyone knows who they are, but I don't have any experience of like personality. I don't know. I know who the Turtles are. I know who April is. And that was sort of all. So going into this movie was a treat. I do think I saw the Megan Fox one in theaters and then blacked it out.
Yeah.
Because as it seems like most fans of the franchise did. Not a slight to Megan Fox at all, because she has only been done disservices in this lifetime. Mm-hmm. Anyways. Yeah. So I hadn't had much experience with the franchise, but I always like liked them in theory. I was like, I don't think I have anything against these guys. They seem, I know they like pizza. I like pizza. Mm-hmm. I know they have the names of classical artists. Still haven't really cracked that. Don't really understand it. But I'm on board. I'm ready to learn. And this movie was, first of all, a hoot and a romp. There's a lot to discuss, which we will.
Yes.
But it was a hoot and a romp, and it was mercifully 88 minutes long. And it's actually 81 minutes with the credits.
I know.
I just love when movies are that length.
Same.
Caitlin, what's your history with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
I love these little turtles, specifically this movie.
They're big, Caitlin. They're not little at all. They're too big.
You're right. I love these large turtles, specifically this movie, because we were trying to figure out which Turtles movie to cover. And I was like, I know this is the sequel, but I want to talk about this one. I don't want to talk about the first or the third or really any other installments in the franchise, because this is a movie I've seen probably like 50 times. Like, it was just like on a loop in my house as a kid. Mm. I played with Turtles toy, like the action figures as a kid. I had like the regular ones. I had the astronaut ones. I don't remember when or if they go to space at any point.
There's astronaut ones?
But I had astronaut That's turtle awesome. Figurines. And then a few years ago, because my fandom has like, I guess, just always stuck with me. And a few years ago, I wrote a sketch called Sex and the Sewer.
This I've seen many times.
Thank you so much, Jamie. It's a combination of Ninja Turtles and Sex and the City, where I mapped each of the four turtles onto each of the four main Sex and the City characters, and I have them just out for a pizza cocktail, chatting about their horny turtle sex lives. It is my magnum opus, and I'll post it on, you know, our Twitter or whatever.
Please.
It's on YouTube if you search Sex and the Sewer.
I was recently introduced to it. Mm. It is hilarious. I loved every second of it. Comedy genius.
Thank you Truly. So much.
It is a classic of the genre, and I will stand by that till the day I die.
Thank you very much. And speaking of cowabunga, it obviously makes an appearance in reference to bung being another name for like butt or anus.
Why are you saying anus right now? I'm sorry. This is a family show.
I feel no need to defend myself. I'll say anus again.
Oh my god.
Anyway, so. Anyway, bung, cowabunga, a hilarious joke, one of many in Sex and the Sewer. Anyway, I love this movie. 10 out of 10 on the rompometer.
Oh, yeah.
There are many things to talk about. It's got some problems.
I did not see the Vanilla Ice musical number coming. Imagine not knowing that was coming and the shock you feel when it starts.
I simply cannot imagine.
It felt really good. Mm-hmm. I woke right up. I watched it pretty early in the morning, and then all of a sudden it was wide awake.
Amazing.
I'm pretty sure that my mother has home video footage of me performing that song in front of the television with Vanilla Ice.
Oh, that's so sweet.
In college, my best friend and I learned the dance that the turtles do to Vanilla Ice's Ninja Rap. And we rehearsed it and we practiced it and we sometimes would do it at parties. So
is there video evidence of that? Because I would love to see it.
Unfortunately, no.
Drop the footage.
There's not. But I'll relearn it.
I would also settle for you doing it now. Yeah, it's like, let's just learn it.
Yeah.
Yes. We're already, the day we're recording this, we're already working on our Magic Mike choreography. So we might as well just throw another number into rehearsal.
Exactly. All right, so should I just get into the recap and we'll go from there?
Let's do it.
Okay. So again, this movie is a sequel. It is the second installment in the original live action trilogy. So I'll just give a really quick recap of the first movie from 1990, mm-hmm. where we meet the four turtles, Leonardo, Donatello, Michelangelo, and Raphael, as well as their mentor / father figure, a giant rat named Splinter. We learn about their backstory. They had come into contact with radioactive ooze from a canister as baby animals 15 years prior, which made them human-sized, and it made them able to talk and have complex thoughts and feelings.
And in the case of the reboot movies, the Megan Fox movies, made them some of the scariest looking computer generated characters ever committed to film.
Yeah. And I also think it changed, those movies changed their backstory. It made them like aliens or something. I haven't seen them, but I remember that being, there was a lot of outcry about that.
Remember when we had time to be upset about things like that?
Okay, so Splinter taught the turtles ninjutsu, And then throughout the movie, they eat pizza. They rescue and befriend news reporter April O'Neil. They fight the bad guys, who are the Foot Clan and their leader, Shredder. The Turtles win, and it seems like they've defeated and killed Shredder at the end of the movie. So Secret of the Ooze picks up basically right after that. We open on shots of New York City. Ever heard of it? Where everyone is eating pizza. We meet Kino, played by Ernie Reyes Jr. He's a pizza delivery guy who heads out to deliver an order for April O'Neil.
But not before body shaming a girl.
Yes.
Before jumping on his... You're just like, whoa! Unfortunately, it doesn't generally stay at that vibration for the whole movie, but it was a wild first dialogue exchange.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
So he's out to deliver this pizza, but on the way, he discovers a bunch of criminals stealing electronics. He fights them because he also has martial arts training, but there are too many of these criminals. But don't worry, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles show up and save the day.
Woo!
The Turtles head back to April O'Neil's apartment. We see her on screen for the first time. She's played by Paige Turco in this movie.
She's played by a different person than the last movie.
Correct. I could not find out why she got recast.
I found something there.
Oh, okay. All right.
Basically, it was the director of the previous movie. I don't know if the first and second movies are directed by the same person, but
I think it's different people.
They basically claimed that she was difficult. Turco replaced Judith Hoag for this film and the following film. According to Hoag, she was not approached to reprise the role because the producers thought she complained too much during the first movie.
Oh.
So, women be getting labeled as difficult and losing jobs. So What a thrilling tale. Never heard that one before.
So this April is played by Paige Turco. They go to her apartment where the Turtles and Splinter are staying because they can't go back to the sewer right now because the Foot knows where they live. Then we cut to a landfill. Shredder survived! Then we cut to a junkyard where what's left of the Foot Clan regroups. We see Shredder's right-hand man, Tatsu. He's throwing a fit. But then Shredder shows up, played by Francois Chau. He shows up, he's hungry for revenge, and he wants to find and destroy the Turtles.
Yeah.
Then we meet Professor Jordan Perry, played by David Warner, aka Lovejoy from Titanic.
I know, I was so thrilled.
Yep.
I don't think once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it. I don't know if I would have gotten there on my own.
So because I saw this movie a bazillion times before Titanic came out, when Titanic came out, I was like, oh my god, it's the professor from Secret of the Ooze.
Wow, the director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 would be so thrilled to hear that, I'm sure.
Okay, so the professor is helping with cleanup of toxic chemicals from a company called TGRI. April interviews him for the news. She's suspicious. She senses something is going on with TGRI, especially because this toxic waste seems to be mutating things nearby. Like we see these huge mutated dandelions. And Shredder gets wind of this toxic waste and wonders if he might be able to use it against his enemies. Meanwhile, Splinter reveals that the radioactive material that mutated the turtles when they were babies was the same toxic waste from TGRI. So it's all connected. So the turtles go to TGRI to investigate, but the Foot also shows up and steals the one remaining canister of ooze, which is what everyone calls it.
Deus ex ooze situations in this movie. Sometimes you're just like, what's happening? And then you're like, okay, the ooze is back. I'm assuming that things are back on track. As long as you can keep your eye on the ooze, you can sort of figure out what's going on.
The ooze is kind of the like connective glue, so to speak, that really holds this movie together.
Classic ooze.
So they've also kidnapped the professor, the Foot has, who Shredder forces to administer the ooze to a couple of dangerous creatures, but we don't know what exactly. We have yet to get a big reveal. Then Kino shows back up to April O'Neil's place because he had seen the turtles in that first sequence, and he's like, what's going on? What are these turtles all about? So he wants more information. He discovers them there. He tells them that the Foot Clan is recruiting, especially teenagers with martial arts experience. And he's like, sure. Ooh, if I get recruited, we can like find their headquarters and then take them down. But Splinter's like, no, that's too dangerous. Then the turtles go back to the sewer to try to find a spot to live. They find an abandoned subway station, but Raphael is pissed, I think because they're like not doing anything to try to get the ooze back from the foot. So he storms off. He does this a lot because he also does this in the first movie.
Oh, does he? Okay, that's good to know. I do appreciate how this very New York movie, even when you're in the world of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, it's so elevated, it's still really hard to find an apartment.
Right?
Like, that's a level of realism I wasn't anticipating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so meanwhile, the creatures that the professor had mutated are ready for their big debut. It is a giant mutant wolf and snapping turtle, Toka and Rezar.
I love them.
They're great. They're amazing.
They're like, mama.
Right, because they're babies.
They're babies.
They're babies. I used to scream that around my house as a kid all the time.
It's so funny. It's so funny and sweet. And I feel like it, without trying to, accidentally comments on the Born Sexy Yesterday trope where it's like something that comes out that's supposed to be very fully formed. And then it's like, goo goo gaga. You're like, oh, yeah, it's a baby.
That's how that would work.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're not very cognitively developed, but they are strong and still dangerous. So Kino, who has linked up with Raphael, gets recruited into the foot so that Kino can learn their secrets and double-cross them. Mm-hmm. But then the Foot Clan kidnaps Raphael. So the other turtles go to the junkyard to rescue him, but Shredder springs a trap. There's a big fight. Shredder unleashes Toka and Rezar, and the turtles are no match for them. So they run away, and they bring the professor with them, who gets to work on developing an antidote to unmutate Toka and Rezar, which the professor reveals those animals will have to ingest. So the turtles have the idea to put the antidote into donuts and feed those to Toka and Rezar. Mm-hmm. So that night, the turtles go back to the junkyard for the big fight.
There's so many fights in this movie. It's very exciting.
Truly. They feed the donuts to Toka and Rezar, but another fight breaks out. And as they're fighting, they crash into a nightclub where Vanilla Ice is performing.
Woohoo! Which in 1992 New York, that also is very possible.
True. So Vanilla Ice is, you know, rapping.
Whatever it is they do.
Right. And then everyone at the club is watching this fight happen. So then Vanilla Ice improvises one of the best songs of all time, Ninja Rap. And then at one point, the turtles burst out into a choreographed dance, which I later learned and performed as well.
Who could blame you?
But then Shredder bursts in. He drinks a vial of ooze, which not only makes him bigger and stronger, but it also mutates his outfit and makes it spikier.
I liked that. Yeah.
It's really good. There's so many things about this movie that as a kid I did not question for a second. And then as an adult, I'm like, why did the ooze mutate his spikes? I don't know.
His outfit. I mean, it stands to reason. I didn't ask. I honestly didn't ask that question. And I'm almost 30 years old. So.
Okay. So the turtles are trying to fight Super Shredder, which I also had a toy of as a kid, brag. They're on a dock now, And Super Shredder is just like tearing everything down around him, and he ends up getting crushed when the whole thing collapses. But the turtles avoid getting crushed because they are like, we're turtles, we can jump in the water. And then the movie ends with the turtles back at their new home, and Splinter says, go ninja, go ninja, go. And then freeze frame, and the movie's over after 81 minutes.
On half a flip. Incredible. Every movie should do this.
Yes.
Including the freeze frame on a mid flip. That is how the Robert Pattinson Batman movie should have ended. Go Batman, go Batman, go. Flip. Directed by Matt.
I don't know.
Who knows? What his last name could be anything. Matt.
The movie Doubt should have ended.
No! Not the movie.
Oh, no.
Meryl Streep doing apple flip.
Freeze frame.
Go, Sister Aloysius. Go, Sister Aloysius. Go. Flip. Oh, my God.
Oh, we haven't brought up Doubt in a while.
Yeah, it's I've found that it tends to bring down the mood of any discussion that we're having.
Well.
But I would love to see Meryl do a flip as Sister Aloysius, but only as Sister Aloysius. I'm not interested in it.
Yeah.
In any other character of hers. Actually, no. Maybe what's her name? The devil who wore Prada. I would oh, love okay. that. Miranda Priestly is who.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll allow it.
I thought it was a very satisfying ending.
Yes. Let's take a quick break and then we will come right back to discuss.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Where should we begin?
Well,
I'll let you guys steer.
Oh my gosh. Carlos, does anything jump out to you as a good place to start as the resident PhD haver? I feel so inadequate next to you, but with only my measly master's degree.
I'm going to be like you, be like, I have a PhD. I don't like to bring it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I think just talking quickly about some of the parallels between the first movie and the second movie, because as you were giving the recap, I realized that Raphael is in trouble in both movies. So he goes out by himself, gets beat up and left for dead in the first one, and then ends up getting kidnapped and tied to a big pole in this one.
Yeah, it's like, yes.
Sir, can you learn your lesson and not go out by yourself?
Honestly, I wrote down for when the way that Raphael, he looks like Kirsten Dunst in the spider web at the peak of Spider-Man 2, where it's just well, I guess he's not going to be allowed to participate in this scrap. It was fun.
But then he is, because
then he's unlike Kirsten
a turtle, and not a damseled woman. But on that line of thinking,
yeah.
Because a lot of the notes I have as they relate to April O'Neil's character, a lot of it is how her character is treated in the first movie versus the second one. So for anyone who hasn't seen the first movie, here are a few things of note that happen in relation to her character. So the first Ninja Turtles movie that came out like 1 year prior to this one, it makes April have to be rescued at least twice by the turtles. So it damsels her, and then she has to be rescued twice. During at least one of these rescues, she is hit in the face by some members of the Foot Clan multiple times. So she is assaulted quite a bit. The movie also puts her in a romance with Casey Jones, which I think is like canon to the comics, which I never really read, but I did watch the animated series as a kid, although I don't remember it at all.
I did a little bit of research on it, and it seems like she's treated much the same, like I think particularly bad in the original comics, where she's like really like drawn exploitatively and like just someone that people say plot to. And then it sounds like the animated series attempted to give her a character, but maybe not very well.
Yeah, so the first movie includes the Casey Jones character. They are put into a like romantic, like a flirtation slash romantic tension, and eventually they kiss at the end. He is a jerk to her the whole time. And then there's also some like not very appropriate for a kid's movie stuff that happens, where he gives her a very horny massage at one point, where he is first like shoves her down in a chair in a pretty violent way, and then he starts to give her a massage in which he is almost like touching her breasts. And it's just like, why is this happening in this PG movie? So basically, in this first movie, she's damseled, battered, and treated poorly by her love interest.
I hate how in the second movie they deal with that by being like, let's just not have her be in it that much, question mark. Then we can't do anything fucked up to her.
Yeah. So in Secret of the Ooze, April doesn't have to be rescued at any point.
Some random lady does at the Vanilla Ice concert, but who was that?
That was just a random lady who loved ninja rap. And that's also, I mean, not that this excuses it, but that's like a very brief moment. It's not like a super like plot, like none of the plot really revolves around that.
No, it's just to the point where it was weird that it was included at all. I was like,
right.
Damseling someone we don't know for 30 seconds and then having it be completely fine. And then she also does put a button on the scene by passing out again.
Fainting,
because women be fainting.
Women be fainting. But to be fair, Kino faints at one point in the movie.
Does.
So they are giving equal opportunity
fainting.
Right. So April does not have to be rescued. She's not wedged into a relationship with an asshole or anyone, which also reduces the ways in which she was like over sexualized in the first movie. So we're not really seeing any of that in this sequel. So like you said, Jamie, she just like isn't given a lot to do. I would say her involvement in the story isn't zero, because she is investigating TGRI, but also nothing that she does in this movie has any real bearing on the plot.
I was going to say, I think you could take her I mean, I know you can't canonically take her out of the franchise, but you could take her out of this plot and not much would change, which I feel like is such a bizarre, like, moment in feminism in like one particular way, where it's like, I don't know, like that whole third wave thing of like, well, you can't be mad at us because we gave her a job. And it's like, well, but the job she's doing, does it have any bearing on what's happening
or any decision she makes at all?
Right. And most of the time in her job, I was like a little frustrated to see that almost every piece of information she makes, she kind of encounters by mistake. Like, we don't get to see her do a lot of investigating. It's mm-hmm. she encounters the plot information she needs by accident, and then she's like, I knew it. And you can tell that, like, in the early 90s, this was like feminism, she has a job. And she, and
there's another little glimpse of that when her boss is like, it's ratings week, drop this TGRI story, do something really interesting. And then he like hands her a piece of paper and she's like, oh, swimsuits of the 90s. And he's like, yeah, I find that really interesting. And like her reaction, we're supposed to be like, yeah, she doesn't care about, you know, women in swimsuits. She cares about this hard hitting journalism she's doing. But it's like,
which is like, she's fair not enough.
Right.
But then let her do the hard hitting journalism.
Right.
Yeah, she could have easily been with Jerry, her, like, assistant cameraman, assistant person, when he finds the dandelion.
Right.
Like, she could have easily snuck in with him, or it been her by herself, and then she tells Jerry, and then he tells Shredder. Like, that could have been a moment for her to be more active in the story.
Totally.
Totally. It felt like she... It's interesting to know that there was all this shoehorned in love interest stuff in the first movie, because it felt like in lieu of that they were just like, well, we're just not going to have her around as much, when it's like, instead of finding ways to meaningfully include her in the plot, when it sounds like canonically she's a great character to have there because she's theoretically an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
Bizarre.
Right.
And on the tail of the first one, she's now the highest paid investigative reporter in New York City to afford a two-level apartment after days of her old apartment burning down. Oh. It's like...
And it's like, too bad for New York City, because this lady isn't investigating a damn thing. She's...
She does yell at the chief of police a lot, and yes. I do appreciate that this movie and the first one, I did not go back and rewatch the third movie because it sucks, but
yeah,
these two movies present cops in a way that shows them as being like severely incompetent and never handling things properly, mm-hmm. to the point where April says to the police chief, like,
yes.
She's like, I guess you're not the ones who are going to handle this, right after, like, there's a yes. scene where Toka and Rezar like wreak havoc on the city, and the police chief is just like, that's what we do best, not handle things. And we're like, woohoo. That's pretty cool for a 90s movie.
I like that. And I also liked, I have a question for the two experts in the room. Uh-huh. I like how the turtles have this like story that's connected to environmental disaster, and that this movie also kind of like the ooze is like this vaguely environmental story. Is that something mm-hmm. that happens on the show a lot? Because I thought that that was really cool.
I actually don't know. It's been such a long time since I've watched the shows. I feel like it was part of that trend in the early 90s where it's like Captain Planet, the Power Rangers, the Turtles, everyone had the environment and being environmentally conscious on their radar. But I'm not sure how deeply it goes in Turtles canon.
Yeah.
And then they forgot. I'm curious because I know that this franchise is being rebooted again mm-hmm. by, I think, Seth Rogen.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And I would be surprised if that didn't come into the news story, because it's like they lend themselves very well to an environmental crisis story that hopefully isn't too depressing.
Right, because their whole origin is we came in contact with toxic waste.
Mm-hmm.
But that was actually a good thing, because they turned into these awesome crime fighting martial arts experts.
Yeah, it's gonna be a very like don't worry guys, everything's gonna actually be awesome when the environment collapses.
Yeah, we'll just all turn into these amazing superheroes.
Yeah, pizza-eating turtles.
Another thing about April, even though this movie doesn't foist a romantic relationship on her, the turtles all have a crush on April, especially Michelangelo, or at least he's the most vocal about it. Mm-hmm. And I just got to think, like, what if you were a grown adult human woman and there are these four horny teenagers that all have a big crush on you, and then they're all also mutant turtles?
See, that's where you lose me.
It's a weird choice, I think. But
it's wild.
But it also feels so of the era, yeah, yes. To do that.
Yes.
It's also interesting because I watched the first one and the second one pretty close back to back to prep for this episode. Mm-hmm. I also watched the third one, which choices. But there's a scene when Master Splinter is kidnapped in the first movie where they come to her door crying. And so it's very much like, you are the only adult we can turn to, while also mm-hmm. still having this sort of hypersexuality. It's like, we want to bone you, but you're also kind of a mother figure in the first one.
Right. I couldn't tell. I settled on Big Sister because I'm like, is she mommy? It made me feel better to think of her as Big Sister. Sorry, can we just pause for a second? Sunny just got here.
Yeah.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's return.
Back from Sunny,
Sunny might be running back and forth, and there's not going to be a way around.
Right. So, yeah, she's not mommy, really. Like, Splinter's definitely daddy. Mm-hmm. But she's not big sister because they all want to have sex with her.
Maybe it's like a creepy babysitter kind of thing.
It's babysitter. That might be it.
Yeah, because it's like she's not. Yeah, I agree that she's not exactly mommy, but she does take on this like caretaking role for them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And she worries about them, but she's clearly not like into them.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah, she wants them out of her apartment.
She's like, I'm the highest paid journalist in New York City. I'm trying to fuck. All these turtles and a rat are like living here.
I love, imagine her Bumble profile. She's like, we can't go back to my place. Not that it isn't nice, but I just have some things going on right now.
There might be four strange teenage boys in and out of my apartment at all times.
Right. And they're like, oh, okay, unmatch. They're like, wait, no, they're turtles.
They're like, what?
Well, that doesn't make it any less weird. For the only woman in the movie to be the like caregiver slash person that they all have this like little, you know, like teen infatuation mm-hmm. with, and then for her to also not really be allowed to do anything narratively significant, mm-hmm. don't love it.
It sucks. And it also, I definitely saw the first Megan Fox Ninja Turtles movie in theaters because, fun fact, mm-hmm. or maybe it was, how many Teenage Mutant, I saw the one that came out in like the late 2000s, whatever one that was.
So there are two. There's one from 2014 and there's a sequel to it from 2016, both produced by Michael Bay.
Okay, what was the one that came out in like 2007? 2007, there was another one. So I saw that one.
Okay, so there's a computer animated one called TMNT.
Chris Evans. It's the Chris Evans Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Because that was my cousin's first date, and I was like her kid cousin, and she's like, "You're gonna come with me."
Oh, you were a little chaperone?
Yeah, I was a baby chaperone. I was like, "No kissing while I watch."
That's adorable.
Creepy. Anyways, I guess all that to say, I know that there are movies that treat April O'Neil much worse than this movie does.
Oh, no.
Well, because in the Megan Fox ones in particular, which this one isn't, this is the Sarah Michelle Gellar one, apparently. I don't remember. I mean, all that to say, like, Megan Fox was given the full-on Megan Fox treatment of how she was treated in every movie, where her body was super exploited, where she was like given love interests and just all this stuff. And it's so frustrating in these franchises that all they need to do is involve more women or less guys that only have one idea, because it seems like the only alternative to treat April not horribly is to like reduce her presence, which is so not true. Especially it's mm-hmm. extra frustrating when it's like in the bones of the character for her to be very useful to any plot involving the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Mm-hmm. I know.
She's got contacts. She can make calls. She's probably got people who will tell her things off the record so she can like sneak around and get information. It's like, no, we're just gonna have her chillin' in nowhere.
Right. And I don't know if like the you know, this property's logic is, well, she doesn't have martial arts training and therefore she can't participate in the action scenes. But it's like, well, then that's all the more reason to give her other things to do.
Right.
Yeah, there's so much surface world stuff she could be doing, like dealing with the police. She could be dealing with any of these business owners. Does no one have security cameras that she can like steal the footage and use in her reports? Like,
right, because that's the other thing. They have to like stay in the shadows because they're human-sized turtles.
Which another thing I really enjoyed about the movie is that they don't seem to be making much of an effort to hide in the shadows. It's so funny. Like when there's a computer sequence that is so computers, it made me laugh so much. Where they're
a
computer in hands. Like, and they're so goofy.
Yeah,
but they're like, theoretically, they snuck in there and they're screaming. They're so loud and mm-hmm. they're huge turtles and they just are making no effort to conceal themselves, which is sort of what is being said to them at the end of the movie, where they're like, yeah, we're so discreet. Like, I just, it's so funny.
Yeah. And then Splinter's like, he holds up the, what made the newspaper, a photo of them dancing to ninja rap. And he's like, try harder.
Okay, you're telling me that would be front page news if four human-sized turtles started dancing in public and then, like, right? almost killed people. Mm-hmm. That would be front page news.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That's a documentary.
Yes.
Right.
The thing that was jarring watching them back to back is in the first one, when her boss and his son come over, they hide so well.
Yes.
For the most part. One of them is caught under the table, but then is immediately gone. To watch this right after, why is your foot there for Kino to step on? Like, okay. You lost all of your ninja skills.
So they can do it. Like, but yeah. Sometimes they just don't. And it's really funny.
That scene that you're referring to, Carlos, so there's a scene where Kino shows up to April's apartment because he's like, something's going on. I saw these turtles and I want to know more about it. He shows up under the guise of like, I've brought you a pizza. And she's like, well, I didn't order a pizza. And he's like, that's okay. I'll just come in. So he comes in uninvited. He's like, what are these doing here? Referring to the nunchucks. And then rather than April being like, who are you? Please get out of my house. You're trespassing. What's it to you what these nunchucks are doing here?
She can sense he's an important side character in the film. So she doesn't kick him out.
But she's like just being really defensive about like, these are my nunchucks. Look at me practicing them. And it's just like, you can just tell this stranger who's intruding onto your property to leave.
You need to go. Like in another movie, that is the setup for a horror, a Lifetime movie,
that
a thriller.
That's the beginning of Funny Games, like right? When you let a stranger into your home and then Kino's holding her hostage and it's the scariest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
God, I don't know why I just conjured that movie. It's so scary.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, that was a choice, Jamie.
Sorry.
Which on the tail end of the first movie, because this is days later, like Shredder is in the garbage at the end of the first one. He's found in the dump like a day, maybe 2 days later. Like,
right.
She should be very reticent and fearful of random people coming to her door trying to find her. Like,
right.
Her house was just burned down and her dad's shop. And she got, I know we're talking about the second one. We are talking about the second
one. No, but she, like in the first movie, she's like.
Wait, her dad was shot?
No, he had a shop and it was burned down. Oh, she kept it open for him.
That's still pretty bad.
But in the first one, she's assaulted by the foot and then later kidnapped. Or I forget exactly all what happens, but like she, like multiple times she's in these dangerous situations. And then, in this one, she's just like, come on in, pizza guy. These are my nunchucks and show yourself around. It's totally fine. So yeah, that was bizarre.
I guess it would make sense if you had four ninja turtles in your apartment. Maybe you wouldn't be scared of one dude at the door. Maybe.
Right.
But even I'm just still like, no, like self-preservation. Where is it?
That's why it's like, I feel like April is like treated like such a plot character that in moments like that where it's like, well, she just needs to behave however the plot needs her to behave in order for this movie to be 81 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, we've got minutes to play around with. She doesn't have to be thrilled about this.
Right. It's frustrating.
I was interested to learn about the actor who plays Kino. I wasn't familiar with him, but apparently I'm very familiar with his work because he's like a famous stunt performer who's been doing stunts since he was a child. So he was Donatello's stuntman in the first TMNT, and then he was just upgraded to human character in the second one, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And then he's done he did stunt work in Avatar. He did stunt work in Tim Burton, Alice in Wonderland. Like he's kind of a legend. He hosted a reality show on MTV in 2009. Who didn't?
What?
it was about stuntmen. It wasn't totally random, but like, he's just been in goddamn everything. He was in the really bad Shia LaBeouf Indiana Jones. Mm. You know, I just was so thrilled to learn about learn about him, if nothing else. Kino's character is a little all over the place.
Yeah.
Although I did like that he was given a fully realized arc. I wish April had had a similar treatment by the movie.
Sure.
It'd be nice.
Also, when I watched this movie for the first time to prep for this episode, I watched it with friend of the cast, Sammy Junio.
Sammy!
And I was also talking about this movie with another friend, and they both said the exact same thing, which is that Kino in this movie, again played by Ernie Reyes Jr., along with Rufio from the movie Hook, played by Dante Basco, are the only two examples of Filipino representation they saw in kids' media or just like media in general growing up.
Wow.
So like, yeah.
That is, that's so bleak. And also, I'm very glad that Ernie Reyes Jr. is in this part.
Mm-hmm. Which might be a smooth transition to another topic of conversation, which is the representation of Asian people and culture in this movie.
Cool boy.
Where to begin?
Well, so the two main bad guys who like have names and are in leadership positions, Shredder and his like second in command, Tatsu, are canonically Japanese characters, like in the comics, and they get some more backs, especially Shredder gets backstory in the first movie. He's from Japan. So there's that. There are aspects of Japanese culture attributed to the good guys in that the turtles study and practice ninjutsu. Splinter grew up in Japan. Also, Splinter speaks with a Japanese accent.
Although I believe that he's voiced by an American puppeteer.
Yes.
And a very controversial one at that.
Right. And then also, these characters, the turtles and Splinter, are not visually Japanese human beings because they're turtles and a rat.
Right.
And yes, you said, Jamie, the actor who voices Splinter is a black actor named Kevin Clash, who is also the voice actor and puppeteer of Elmo. I don't know any other information about him. So if you have...
I can give you a very... It's a very difficult story. But basically, he was a famous puppeteer, one of the most prominent black puppeteers in the world. He was Elmo for a long time and then was made to resign as Elmo because there were a lot of allegations of him having sex with underage teenagers.
Oh,
and
no.
So there's a lot. It was a huge story 10 years ago, and I feel like no one really talks about it anymore. He has since begun working again. There's been a lot of conversation around the topic that I have not kept up with, but definitely a massive fall from grace from a very well-respected puppeteer. Ugh. As far as it's relevant to this conversation, he's not an Asian actor putting on a very, very stereotypical, you know, tropey accent.
Correct.
Is this, do we know if Splinter, also Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are canonically written by two white guys from New England, are they not?
Like, yes.
So the well is poisoned from the very beginning. Don't let two white guys from New England do literally anything. How has history taught us nothing? Like, why would you, Wahlburgers? Like, are you kidding me? Anyways, bad idea. Never do it. But yes, no, I will, Caitlin, I'll send you some links to the conversation around Kevin Clash because I am not an authority in it, but I do remember that. Splinter. Is Splinter canonically based on Mr. Miyagi? That was what I was picking up on, but I also don't know, like, the timeline of that because the same tropes are present in that character, it feels like.
Right. Karate Kid came out in 84, and the first issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the comic, because that was like the source material, the original source of everything, also was published in, oh my gosh, Carlos is holding up.
You have it?
The issue.
Wow.
It was also published in 84. So I think it's just sort of like similar concepts happening at the exact same time, not one based on the other, I would guess. But
so two white guys doing the same offensive thing in the same calendar year? Shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, in conclusion, most of the East Asian human beings, again, because you have to differentiate that from, like, the rat, the people, the Japanese characters, are bad guys. And in addition to that, there's just a lot of stereotypes of East Asian and Japanese culture specifically being used. There's also that sort of like, all East Asian people know martial arts is something that's being telegraphed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then I feel like the turtles are coded white, especially in contrast to the very stereotypical Asian villains.
Mm-hmm.
So
are they, they're all voiced by white actors, is that correct? I was having trouble fact checking.
I think that for the most part that is true. And then there's also some differentiation in who was voice acting some of the characters from the first movie to the second one. I think two of the voice actors got recast. In Secret of the Ooze,
Brian Tochi voices Leonardo. And I believe he is Japanese.
Right. Yes. Okay, so IMDb is tricky because it's like this actor as Leonardo, but like in the suit. And then it's this different actor as Leonardo as the voice. Right. So it's like I'm trying to figure out all this.
I was just thinking voice because that is
right
how their personalities are telegraphed.
Right.
No disrespect to the suit performers. I would not want to do that job.
Yeah, the voice actors are primarily white, and
with the exception, I believe, of Brian Tochi, who voices mm-hmm. Leonardo,
right,
and Kevin Clash, who is a black actor but doing an offensive Asian
right
accent. My head hurts.
So there's a lot going on. The movie stereotypes and demonizes Asian people in a very harmful way. Mm. It's borrowing elements from Japanese culture like ninjutsu and basically saying like when the white-coded characters do it, it's good and it saves the day. Mm. But when the Japanese characters do this thing from their own culture, it's bad. So there's a lot of fuckery happening there.
Yeah.
And they're sort of bringing in lots of white youth to be the Foot Clan. And so across both movies, a lot of the Foot are drawn from runaways in New York City. And so one would expect there to be more diversity, especially along gender lines in the Foot, given that a good number of runaways are girls. They are across all races, all sexualities, but it is a very kind of prototypical, largely white mass. And so you've got these Asian bad guys seducing these young white kids into lives of crime and deviance in both movies, more clearly set up in the first one, but the sort of trails are well established in the second one.
Right.
And it is so, and it, this like TMNT was certainly not happening in a void, where I feel like American culture in general was very permissive and actively encouraging these sorts of huge glossed over generalizations about East Asian culture to happen throughout the 80s and 90s and into now. But I feel like it was especially popular around this time and largely written, directed, and acted by white guys.
Yeah.
I also, I don't even know how I feel. Toka and Rezar, I mean, they're just, they're babies, but they're voiced by the guy who did Scooby-Doo. Which I was like,
okay.
I just love, I hope, I don't know anything about his politics or anything like that, but I just love Frank Welker, who's like still alive. He's in his 70s, like started doing, I think we've talked about him on the show before because he's the voice of literally everything famous ever. He started doing voices when he was like in his early 20s, and he's been every famous cartoon character that isn't played by like Tom Kenny, you know, like He's literally Scooby-Doo. Anyways, he's Garfield.
Which begs the question.
He's Megatron.
Where's our Scooby-Doo episode?
He's everyone. He's, sorry. I just, my Frank Welker fandom.
No.
Popped out. And then to find out he's also Toka and Rezar, I mean, he's the Alfred Molina of the vocal cords.
So versatile.
So versatile. He can be dogs and alligators.
He's a snapping turtle and a wolf.
The range. The range.
Okay. So another thing along these lines is the April O'Neil character. And there's some controversy around this because of some kind of ambiguity. Mm-hmm. But she is thought by many to have originally been, in the comics, a black woman.
Oh.
Which is something that is difficult to discern because the interiors of the comic books are black and white. But on the cover of, I think, like the 11th issue of the comic, depicts April O'Neil as a light-skinned woman of color with black curly hair. But then when that issue was reprinted later, she then appears as a white woman with red hair. So people were like, this character is being whitewashed, because this happened in 86 when this was reprinted, I believe. So when asked about this by the co-creators, Kevin Eastman said that April was, quote, originally created as an Asian character in Pete's notes, referring to Peter Laird, the other creator. So originally created as an Asian character in Pete's notes, but named after an African-American woman I once knew. And then Peter Laird says, it depends on which co-creator of the TMNT you ask. Ugh. If you ask me, I always saw April O'Neil as white. If you ask Kevin, I suspect he would say, as he has in a number of interviews, that she was of mixed race, much like his former girlfriend, April. So
say less. Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay, so we have... So Carlos is showing us an image from... What is this from exactly?
So this is from a colorized version of the graphic novel that compiled the original issues together in color.
Okay.
So I can post this and give you the information. Yeah, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, book 2, first graphic novel, number 10. Copyright 1987 Mirage Comics. So the originals were like this, mm-hmm. and then they did a colored issue. Full color deluxe format, the graphic novel became an instant bestseller.
Got it. So the image you just showed us depicts April O'Neil as a light-skinned black woman.
But then if you look at the first, so each version of her is different. So she looks more kind of like the character from this movie that we're discussing here. Mm-hmm. Also sort of mixed. And then you have her again looking... Again, very different, but more sort of the image of April O'Neil that we've come to sort of know and expect.
Yes. Okay.
So I don't know much about the history of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I do know quite a bit about the history of women in comics. And this is something that comes up again and again and again in the history of comics, of characters that were originally black women later being whitewashed once the franchise becomes popular. I believe a similar thing happened to Betty Boop way back in the day. And this is, and I think in the case of Betty Boop and April O'Neil, it's a little complicated by the fact that the character from the jump was heavily sexualized, which is something that affects women of color in all areas, but in, you know, certainly in animation as well. And April O'Neil and Betty Boop are two heavily sexualized and eventually whitewashed characters. It's just it's so frustrating that and who is at the top of those comics? It's always white
men. Yeah,
so it's just, it's really just continued frustrating pattern. I didn't realize that it happened in this case as well. And then, you know, of course, in this era and in all eras before, when black women were working in animation, they were underpaid, unacknowledged, or never hired. And then as it, you know, pertains to right now, even, you know, black women who were very successful in animation are completely erased from its history, and you don't learn that much about them. Sorry, that was a little ACCast side rant, but if anyone wants to learn about an amazing historical, and by that I mean she's dead, but an amazing Black woman who blazed so many trails in cartooning. Jackie Orms is so awesome.
Cool.
And I recommend that everyone learn more about her. That's so frustrating. I didn't know that. Yeah. Now I'm all pissed off.
Yeah, that is something. And of course, in this movie, she is a white character played by a white actor. And I think, I would guess, and Carlos, you probably know more about this than me, but after that, maybe like first string of issues in the comics, she was only depicted as a white woman from then on, like in the animated series. I don't know if she was ever made into an action figure. I don't remember having an April O'Neil action figure, but like much the same way that when like the newest Star Wars trilogy came out and like Rey was the protagonist of those movies and like those toy companies were like, well, why would we have an action figure of Rey? Because she's a woman, you know, like,
right.
Again, I'm kind of speculating here, but like, I don't know if there were April action figures. All this to say that most of the renditions of her post those like kind of original string of issues of the comic depict her as a white woman. And I would say that the turtles are also, again, I think perceived as like white coded characters, even though they're turtles, because I think in at least of the feature films post this trilogy, all of the voice actors who voice the turtle characters are all white actors, cementing that kind of coding.
Well, and it's another, I am saying that there were some April action figures, but I think that that's like, again, further complicated by the fact that she's, by the way her character is written, she's not included in the action. So it's
right.
Like, oh, well, why would we make an action figure for someone who is canonically excluded from all action? It's and also right. The like the, I don't know, the trope of like the sexy woman journalist felt also very prevalent during this time, and in animation in particular, where again, it's just like such a, it's not even a half step, it's a whatever 2% step, because it's like, well, but she has a job, you know, she's not married, but it's like, but she's not there to do journalism. Anything? You know, like she's not there to do what you're saying she's there to do. And so oh, pee pee poo poo.
I'm pretty sure the cartoon up until maybe this movie a little bit and the revivals with the cartoons on Nickelodeon. I think most people, when they think April O'Neil, they think the yellow jumpsuit from her from the cartoon in 87, which white woman, that's where a lot of the action figures sort of began, was based off of the show. So there's like the van they had and all of them with their tools and toys. I'm not sure how much she was involved in the show, because I don't, it's been right. 30 years.
I know, I don't remember it either.
It's been 84 years.
It's been 84 years.
84
and I can
years.
Still hear the original commercials.
So it's definitely ingrained that, like, she's a redhead. She wears the yellow jacket, which is right. Why I think some people were reticent with, aside from, like, the sexism that we love to throw at Megan Fox then and now to a certain degree, was just like, oh, she's not the right fit for the character. I'm like, she can be a badass and do badass things. Why is she not a good fit? Can she stand in front of a mic and talk into it? Yeah, I think she could do the job,
right. Yeah.
Especially given the material that she's given to work with. In this film, I don't remember the recent one to comment.
Were people saying like Megan Fox is like too sexy for
yes
the April? Okay, which is like, oh my god, the standards.
But it's also saying it in the way that it's like, I went back to read some of the coverage from 2014, and it made me want to be, I was just like, oh my god, this is like not even 10 years ago, and this, oh, you could just write this down. Yeah, the tone of all of that reporting was very like, you know, making it seem like it was Megan Fox's fault that she was framed and written in the way that she was, when it's like Megan Fox, by all accounts, was really into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and really liked like nerdy stuff, liked Transformers, and it's like,
yeah,
so she's coming to the project from an honest place, and it's the fucking culture that treats her the way it does. But all of the 2014 coverage was like, Megan Fox ruins this movie, and she was, you know, nominated for Razzies and like just all that shit that is just like, huh, she was doing all she could with what she was given. And anytime she said anything about it, she would get fired. Like Steven Spielberg fired her for insulting Michael Bay, the most insultable person of all time. It's just, ay, ay, ay.
Well, that is terrible. Does anyone have any other thoughts about the movie?
I want a spin-off series for April O'Neil where she can really get into the New York City. I want a version that is like April O'Neil with the turtles as her like investigative assistants, and they're busting shit wide open, and she's delegating to them, and she's training them to be turtle journalists.
Wow.
Turtleists.
And they solve the environmental crisis and save the world. That's the rearranged pieces I want from this.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, you know there's corruption in the police department and city hall that is ripe for the picking,
right?
With the turtles and their access. Mm-hmm.
The turtles can, they can break into anything. They can get her the information she needs, and then she cracks it wide open, and the NYPD is abolished.
Right.
And that's how it ends.
I love this.
Yes. They're defunded completely.
They have so much fucking money. I know that's not what we're talking
billions
about.
Billions of
dollars. They have so much money. Too much money.
It's upsetting.
Not when April's on the case.
One last question. Which turtle do you most identify with? Carlos, you start.
I was hoping this would be a question because I was like, who do I think Caitlin and Jamie are? And I was like, and who am I?
Yeah, who do you think you are?
As a teenager, I was definitely Raphael. I had a lot of anger issues that I had to process and work through. I'm better now. Therapy. I recommend it to my students. I'm like, you should go to therapy. It's good for you. Mm-hmm. Probably Leonardo with like a bit of Donatello because I do have a PhD. Mm-hmm. And he's like become the nerd element of the Turtles.
Donatello.
So yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So probably a bit of Leo, a bit of Donatello. Mm.
Jamie, any thoughts?
I have no idea. you guys are gonna have to tell me which one I am.
Okay. Ooh. Part of me wants to say Michelangelo.
Yes.
But I also identify with Michelangelo because he makes a lot of movie references and he loves movies.
Okay.
But then there's also Raphael. I don't know. I love his hard shell, if you will. His hardened exterior. You know, he's got an attitude problem, but I kind of admire it. So I don't know. Maybe I'm Raphael and Jamie, you're Michelangelo.
Okay, I'm on a Medium.com article I have not vetted, but they're saying that Michelangelo is Ringo Starr, which is always what I'm going for. Love that.
Well, I did a lot of, I had to think very carefully about which character mapped on to which Sex and the City character. Mm. Carrie is Leonardo because they're both like the leaders of the group, was a question mark. Mm-hmm. Raphael is Miranda. Michelangelo is Samantha because they're both the horniest ones. And then Charlotte is Donatello because they're kind of, I don't know. What is Charlotte's personality besides being boring?
The George
No offense.
That's, wow. Okay. We don't have time. We don't have time. Charlotte's complicated.
I was definitely going to give Michelangelo to both of you a bit, but I was also going to have Donatello get a little bit to Jamie because the research that went into my year in Mensa, Atcast, Lolita podcast, just like the journalistic brain and just like Jamie's context corner is always on point, like sort of very intellectual in a really fun way, sort of the Michelangelo of it. And then I was going to say Leonardo for you because you're sort of like the leader, you sort of in charge, running the show
for
a little
me?
Bit. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And you have shorter hair than me, so it follows the rule.
Of the baldest woman in charge.
Mm-hmm. Baldest woman in charge.
Wow.
Oh, it's been a while since I've heard that one.
I know.
Unfortunately, you can't really apply it to this series because you need to have two women for the rule to even come into operation.
Yep.
The baldest turtle. is also not in charge because they're all equal amounts of bold. How many nipples does a turtle have? Turtle facts with Caitlin. The answer is zero because they're reptiles.
Oh. I was once applying a single microsecond of thought, that makes a lot of sense. Does this movie pass the Bechdel test? No, right?
No.
No.
Hard no.
There's no women for her to talk to.
Nope. Except for that one woman at the club who gets kind of held hostage by Shredder for 2 seconds.
And her neighbor who she doesn't talk to in the beginning because she's too busy being engaged with by her boyfriend, husband, and he like takes her keys to let her in the building. It's like, I think she would have gotten it together.
She would have been fine.
Right. I feel like that's the only other woman in this story with a speaking role, and she's only on screen for 30 seconds.
No name, no
and
relevance.
And she doesn't talk to April. Yeah, definitely doesn't pass the Bechdel test. What about our nipple scale, though? 0 to 5 nipples based on examining the movie through an intersectional feminist lens. I would give this a half nipple.
Yeah, that feels right.
Because it, I guess, arguably, it treats the one woman in the entire story better than she was treated 1 year earlier in the first movie. But it's not as though that improvement is very significant because it still does not give her really any narrative bearing on the plot. And she could just be replaced by her own apartment and because they really only...
God, that's bleak.
So that's a big bummer. But I like her as a character. The fact that she like stands up to the chief of police. She stands up to her boss. She stands up to her boss in the first movie too. She's like not afraid to speak out and advocate for herself. And she's like strong and empowered in that way. Unfortunately, it doesn't really have much impact on the larger narrative. Mm-hmm. But I think she is a character to be admired if you just like isolate certain aspects of her character. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. But between like her very minimal actual involvement in the story and the way this movie demonizes and stereotypes Japanese characters is despicable. So half nipple. And I'll give the nipple to Toka and Rezar when they get turned back into their little animals.
Babies. They were so cute. They're just babies.
They're babies. Wait, no. They get an honorable mention, but my half nipple goes to Ninja Rap, the song and dance.
Oh, that's fair.
Ninja
rap.
And I'm like, and you're telling me he improvised this? There's 3 words in the song.
Because the scene goes on for a while. That fight sequence goes on for like probably like 6 minutes or so. And Vanilla Ice is singing the whole time. And if you really pay attention, he's just repeating the lyrics over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was, I think, about where his skills tapped out.
Yeah. So yeah, half nipple, Vanilla Ice's Ninja Rap.
I'm also going to go with a half nipple, for all the reasons you described, Caitlin. I mean, and it was really, thank you both for giving me the context of the, origins of April. The more I learn about this character, the more I'm like, this is a character that had so much potential and has never been seen through to that potential. Because it just, the curse of the late 20th century and 5 trillion white guys being in control of how she's perceived. But like on her face, such a fascinating character that could have brought more diversity to the series. And then they actively chose not to do it. Mm-hmm. Always really frustrating. The treatment of East Asian culture is so just atrocious and also very on par, it feels like, with how East Asian culture was treated. I mean, I don't want to like, you can't even really specifically pull TMNT as especially bad. Like, this was just how Western culture treated East Asian characters at this time.
For sure.
We didn't get a chance to talk about it, but there was a great essay I read in Sci-Fi Wire that came out, I believe, just last year by a writer named Ariel Dean, who talked about, like, TMNT being kind of as close as they could find to East Asian representation when they were growing up in the 90s, and how frustrating that was, but also how it formed a strong connection with the characters, and how that, you know, it's a mm-hmm. pop culture is a motherfucker. It's very complicated and weird. And then you have the babies and I'm laughing, and then you have, they do flips and I'm laughing. And so it's hard. But as far as our scale goes, half nipple for April being there and not being completely abused by the movie, but only because she's not in it. So half a nipple, and I will give it to Frank Welker.
All right.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo. Very nice. Carlos, what about you?
Oh, this is tough. I was like, on the Caitlin's Rompa meter, I know I'm going to give it 10 stars. Like, I know that.
Oh, yeah.
But the nipple scale is hard. I mean,
story of our lives.
We can't give this film credit for the April O'Neil character, but I know in, like, the cartoons and in other iterations more currently, she is often aged down, so she's like a teenager, sort of still doing investigative stuff, and is more active, at least in the Nickelodeon show. Mm-hmm. So the character is treated better in other properties under this sort of umbrella, which is great. Mm-hmm. But we cannot give this movie credit for that. Like you said, with East Asian representations, not great. Like, the whole 90s, I was thinking about Power Rangers a lot during our conversation today.
Yeah.
Sort of doing similar things, sort of just copy-pasting and then recasting mostly white characters and actors in mostly white city, sort of that piece.
Mm-hmm.
The fathers and sons of it all. I was waiting for...
Oh my gosh. We didn't even talk about that, but wait a minute. There's the whole... Splinter's always like, my sons. And we're like, okay, yeah.
God, you're totally right. The movie, even TMNT, is about fathers... and it's about sons. It just makes you sick, doesn't it? Enough. We get it. It's hard.
Which makes it worse, because I watched the first one and I'm like, we don't touch April's trauma of losing her, like, apartment, her dad's store that she kept open in his memory. Like, none of her characterization gets to carry over into the next one other than she has money and a better paying job. Right. I think I'm talking myself into a lower number of nipples. I think I'm going to go one. Sammy and your other friend said, in terms of Filipino representation,
mm-hmm.
It's not the best, but it was something. This was really sort of formative. Looking back, I'm like, PhD representation? What?
Oh, because of the professor?
Which he would just be called doctor in this research place because it's not a university, but that is another conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to say one nipple for all the reasons you said, but giving it a little extra for Filipino representation.
Mm-hmm. True.
Yeah.
Which also, like, it makes the representation of the bad guys a little more complicated because you also have Kino. So it's not as though every Asian character is mm-hmm. a bad guy, because also Splinter is, like, canonically Japanese, but, like, mm-hmm. there's still the optics of a lot of it is still, like, really messed up. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's also really more complicated in the third one, which we didn't watch.
Don't they? Oh, no. They travel back in time in famous third movie of a trilogy fashion.
No,
the yes. characters time travel, and feudal Japan.
Why is that a thing?
Yep, April goes, and then they have to go rescue her from the past.
Okay.
I do. That is fascinating, because it's like the first movie is the first movie, the second movie is the first movie a second time, the third movie they can time travel. This, I feel like you could think of 10 movie franchises where this is the case. That is so wild. I've never thought about that before.
So Men in Black 3. Mm-hmm. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
Evil Dead He time travels in the third movie.
Oh, yeah.
In the third Harry Potter book and movie is the only one that they have time travel. Yes, and it's the only one that there's time travel.
Wild. Why is that? They never do that in the series of unfortunate events. They're too busy rehashing the first book over and over.
I know there's at least like two or three other examples. So listeners, if you have examples, throw them at us. But anyway,
yes, this is the new Leo in not Leonardo, not Turtle Leonardo. We have to differentiate. It's the new Leonardo DiCaprio in a body of water wearing
fully
clothes.
Clothed. Yes.
Yes.
So.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, Carlos, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
It's been a treat. It's been a slice of pizza. Cowabunga.
Cowabunga.
A very merry cowabunga to you, Carlos. Thank you so much for joining us.
My Catholic upbringing, when you said cowabunga to you, I was like, and also with you. But no, thank you for having me. This was great.
Oh my gosh. Come back anytime. Oh,
yay.
Please.
Where can people check out your stuff, follow you on social media, etc.?
Yeah, so I am Carlos Creates 2018 on Instagram. I am also one of the three co-hosts at play.hype.dialogue on Instagram. And I am revamping my professional website to be both part academic and part consultant creative. Mm-hmm. So that's carlosmcamacho.net, but it is a work in progress.
Sure. Aren't we all?
You know, cowabunga.
Cowabunga.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BechtelCast. You can go to patreon.com/BechtelCast and subscribe to our Patreon, aka Matreon, where we do two bonus episodes every month, and then you'll also have access to our entire back catalog, which is over 100 bonus episodes.
Wow.
And we always forget to say this, but why don't you, like us and give us a little, five nipple review.
I love how you're like, we never say this, but why don't you like us?
Why don't you like us?
I thought
like
that was
being like the verb where you like click a like button. But also, why don't you like us?
But also, why don't you like us? What have we ever done?
We're so cool. We say cowabunga. But yeah, write us a five nipple review on, Apple Podcasts or whatever your listening platform is.
And you can check out our merch at tpublic.com/thebechtelcast if you are so inclined. Spring's coming. Carlos is wearing a Queer Icon t-shirt. Why aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Get it together.
Exactly. Get it together, folks.
Jamie, I feel like we should also briefly just touch on the shirt that you're wearing.
I am wearing, I don't even know if it's current, it might be rare at this point, but I'm wearing a shirt that I co-designed with Super Yaki, who advertises on the show. We love them so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, Alfred Molina could have done it.
Yeah.
Which is, first of all, a true statement. And also, second of all, today my boss was like, done what? And I was like,
everything. Alfred Molina could have been every Ninja Turtle, both voice-wise and all of the stunts.
Amen, baby.
Cowabunga to that.
Cowabunga, Alfred Molina.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Ladies and
gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.